Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up, crew? Welcome back to the Cryptoconomy Podcast with Guy Swan, your host. That is me. I promised on Friday, I think that's when the episode came out. My last Guy's Take episode, that I was going to do a follow-up on the whole Bcash fiasco, mostly because I expected to find a lot of new details that I wasn't exactly aware of. And I did find maybe some little tidbits that I don't think I put specifically in the previous episode. But for the most part, it was just people having a very different opinion on the analysis or the conclusion on whether or not that was a good or bad event, which, you know, if you're a Bcash supporter, many of them were just claiming that this was a good thing because the quote-unquote honest, the honest players got the funds as opposed to, or I guess got the funds to the rightful owners as opposed to the thief. But like, that's the whole point of the discussion. Like, that's the whole core of the debate there, is that, well, you just opened the entire thing up to a subjective evaluation of who was honest and who was dishonest. You've eliminated the objectivity of the rules of the system because, like, it's just now completely arbitrary. You've turned it into a social problem rather than a mathematical problem, which is exactly what Bitcoin does, which makes it scalable, in like socially scalable, in the way that Nick Szabo talks about, where you do not have to have the same perspective. You do not have to have the same subjective idea of who the good guy or who the bad guy is. You can objectively trust the definition of Bitcoin, or you can trust the contractual agreement as set aside in the whole proof of work system. And it also completely, I've argued with a couple of people on Twitter who were talking about how, like, no, this is how the white paper works and stuff. But then I'm like, this is exactly against everything that you guys talk about, that, like, you call this electronic cash. What the hell is cash? Like, what's the value of cash? Why is, quote unquote, cash called cash? Like, what makes it what it is? It's that when you send a transaction in cash, when I trade you $10,000 in cash, I can't reverse that payment. I can't get that back. Transaction finality, because of a bearer instrument, is one of the key characteristics of cash. And then at the exact same time, it's also in that we don't need someone else's permission. Like, we don't have some sort of third party that's telling us whether or not I can give you the cash that I have or whether or not you can receive it. Like, those are the characteristics which make cash a powerful and useful economic tool. And this event on Bcash just basically tosses that all out the window. Like, you can't possibly defend this and then say you're still trying to make electronic cash. Those are 100% at odds with what occurred with BTC Top and BTC.com deciding to censor a transaction that they subjectively deemed the dishonest one, replace it with their own, and reverse a transaction that's two confirmations deep. These guys sell themselves as the zero confirmation chain. Bullshit. Your zero comps aren't worth jack if your two confirmation transactions can be easily reversed. So that's pretty much all I've got to add on that, is just that there wasn't much else. If you listen to the previous episode, I kind of hit the core of what actually took place, and that's that. Everything else is just a subjective opinion, and you already know mine. I think it was a real stupid thing, but, you know, to each their own. Didn't even hurt the Bcash price, which is kind of hilarious. Not totally unexpected, though, as I don't think that's what they've prioritized for a very long time. Security, immutability, censorship resistant has not really been their concern. And I think At the same time, Roger has tried so hard to appeal to, I don't want to be mean, but appeal to the dummies coming in who don't know what they're doing or don't have any of the background or the history and don't know the difference between Bitcoin and the Bitcoin fork 1 through 100 to say that Bcash was the real Bitcoin. I think he's specifically played to people's ignorance. So, of course, they'd just kind of go along, many of them at least. I know there are people who believe in Bitcoin Cash and are actually kind of pissed at this and upset, and rightfully so. But I imagine that a significant reason that many of the people are backing this or supporting it and defending it is just because they never understood why there was any need for objectivity. They don't understand social scalability. They haven't read Jack by Nick Szabo. Like they haven't thought really hard about. They clearly don't even understand what cash means, in my opinion. So, I'd say that that's enough to explain that, of course, they're not concerned. So, they never got it in the first place. Anyway, we are going to hit a short one, but a fun one today to start off the week. Sorry about not having one yesterday. I think I said I was going to have one on Monday, but I kind of completely forgot it was Memorial Day and I had a really busy weekend. So, but we are right back into this. And we are going to start with one we're going to be hitting quite a bit by Durjiji in the near future. And if you have not listened to Citizen Bitcoin's episode interviewing him on the 21 Lessons, it's 2 hours of awesomeness. I just finally, wait, no, did I finish it? I feel like I didn't finish it. I don't know. I'm not sure how far I am through it. I know I've listened to like an hour and some change at least, and it's 2 hours long. Okay, I'm an hour and 15 minutes into it. So I still got 45 minutes left. Awesome. That is what I'm going to do while I'm getting my car fixed. Okay, so if you haven't checked out that episode, that is an interview with him all about his 21 lessons, which I will be covering on the show. They kind of talked about this in a, we kind of chatted back and forth about this in a Twitter thread sometime recently, but I'm going to try to make an audio available for his entire 21 lessons on Durjiji.com. That is Durjiji.com. Spelled exactly like it sounds. And we are going to start today, though, with a short one from a good while ago, August 2018. But it's a really fun one, and it's all just like on analogies, and I love stuff that have really fun analogies. This is called The Magic Dust of Cryptography: How Digital Information is Changing Our Society. And you can find it on medium.com or just durjiji.com, The Magic Dust of Cryptography. If you go to this one on Medium, definitely drop some applause up there. But I imagine Gigi would be just as cool with you going to the website so you can check out all the other stuff that he is working on. All right. Without further ado, though, let's go ahead and jump in. We will read and then chat afterward all about The Magic Dust of Cryptography: How Digital Information is Changing Our Society. Imagine you have a hammer, a magical hammer, which can smash anything into pieces with one stroke. Not only that, this hammer can completely pulverize everything it touches into a fine gray dust. Further imagine that there was a magic potion, one drop of which will turn the heap of dust back into the item you smashed. This leads to some interesting questions. Suppose you want to visit a country and you want to bring your favorite pair of pajama pants with you. The only problem, however, is that pants are illegal in this country. Maybe it's a weird country, or maybe that's the reason why you want to go there in the first place. Either way, I don't judge. Now, remember that you are in the possession of this magical hammer. You use it on your pajama pants, and poof, you have a tiny bag of gray dust which you can put in your pocket. The pocket of your jacket, of course, because you will be asked to leave all your pants at the border. Where exactly are the pajama pants now? In the dust? In the potion? Do they currently exist? Does the concept of, quote, "your pajama pants" even make sense? if all you have is indistinguishable gray dust and a tiny drop of magic potion? What if you would only need a drop of water and speak some magic words to turn the dust back into pajama pants? What if the dust was ubiquitous, everywhere on Earth? We as a global society are currently in the process of moving from the physical realm of things to the digital realm of information. We are quickly moving towards the fantastical world of no pants land, and we will have to update our current conceptions of things if we want to stay sane. Many things which used to be on pieces of paper are now digital. Your train ticket, your boarding pass, tickets to a concert, debit cards, credit cards, all of these already moved from being printed on paper to a bunch of zeros and ones, decoupled from the physical realm we are so used to. Even those pieces of paper which encode value itself are slowly but surely moved to the purely digital realm. A rising number of people are willing to convert their hard-earned paper money into Bitcoin, leaving the world of physical money behind completely. Over time, more and more valuable pieces of paper will be eaten up by this digitalization. Soon, your driver's license, your passport, your birth certificate, and other documents will be digital. Why is this a big deal? Digital information is quite different from physical artifacts. It can be easily scrambled, taken apart, and put together again. It has completely novel characteristics compared to the physical stuff we are so used to. It can be duplicated perfectly, checked for authenticity instantly, and hidden in plain sight. Information is independent of a physical substrate and thus can take virtually infinite forms. What the full implications of this digitization will be is impossible to tell. We are not accustomed to this world of information, devoid of physical form, touch, and smell. Remember the tale of No Pants Land? Let's return to this weird and wonderful world, but with a twist. Your pajama pants are now your passport. Let's say that you have a properly encrypted digital passport and a decryption key of sufficient length. You put the encrypted passport in one place and the key in another place. Where is your passport exactly? A or B? Somewhere in between? Does it even exist? Does the question of where make sense in the first place? What if you upload your encrypted passport to the cloud or a distributed storage system like IPFS? What if your encrypted passport was ubiquitous, everywhere on Earth? What if you memorize the key as a mnemonic phrase? Is your passport now in your brain? Does the concept of, quote, your passport even make sense if all you have is access to the internet and some magic words? Warning, the following section contains example private keys. Do not import any sample keys or send bitcoins to the associated addresses. You will lose your money. Take Bitcoin as another example. You are no longer in possession of physical coins or any physical artifact for that matter. No amount of calling these things coins can change that. Even hardware wallets do not change that. You possess a piece of information, your private key, which allows you to spend your funds. Effectively, your private key is your money, which in turn is information. Thus, your money is pure information. A private key is just a bunch of random bits. It can be encoded as a bunch of zeros and ones. 001011, I'm not going to read it all. You get the idea. It could also be heads and tails, as pointed out by Andreas M. Antonopoulos in Mastering Bitcoin. Quote, the Bitcoin private key is just a number. You can pick your private keys randomly just using a coin, pencil, and paper. Toss a coin 256 times, and you have the binary digits of a random private key you can use in a Bitcoin wallet. End quote. Andreas M. Antonopoulos. The same information can be represented as a regular number. 2116634, etc. We can also use the hexadecimal system to represent this number to keep things a bit shorter. 12E188AEB, etc. An even shorter representation would be the wallet import format. 5HXBS, etc. The same information can be coded as a mnemonic code, resulting in these 24 words, which you could remember with a bit of practice. Concert, frozen, pull, battle, spend, etc., etc. Or if you're Japanese. I assume those are the same words in Japanese. I have no idea. Of course, we can also encode this information as various images. Your private key as a QR code. Private key encoded as hex colors. You can also be more creative and hide a Bitcoin private key in a piece of art. Torched Hearts by YT, a puzzle which hid 4.87 Bitcoin in plain sight. Graphic. You get the idea. Why is this a big deal? All right, so my Bitcoin blanket fort is getting a little bit hotter, a little bit faster than it usually does. I think it's just because it's like 90 billion degrees outside. I am going to take a break here and get myself an ice cold beverage, probably coffee, and we will be right back. Let's hit our sponsor during this break, and we'll jump right back in at why is this a big deal? Why is this a big deal? Our current way of doing things is adapted to the physical, not the digital world. Some laws and regulations which made sense previously might not be very useful in the abstract space of zeros and ones. Quote, central banks now have a way of stopping competition by just passing laws as they have always done. They are now up against a digital competitor that most likely cannot be brought under the physical world's laws. End quote. Saifedean Ammas, The Bitcoin Standard. Governments and corporations will continually try to outlaw certain kinds of information. It is likely that the last battle of the crypto wars hasn't been fought yet. And yet, it seems that it will be harder and harder for governments and companies to outlaw the use of these algorithms. After all, these mathematical magic tricks are themselves information, making them virtually unstoppable in the very same way as the information they manipulate. As long as we aren't under the rule of a worldwide totalitarian dictatorship, people will continue to exercise their freedom of speech to print encryption algorithms on t-shirts, design flags to distribute cryptographic keys, and sing songs containing illegal information. Due to the nature of information discussed above, outlawing any information leads to absurd consequences. Since information can be encoded in a myriad of ways, banning information leads to illegal numbers and other absurdities. Quote, any piece of digital information is representable as a number. Consequently, if communicating a specific set of information is illegal in some way, then the number may be illegal as well. End quote. Wikipedia contributors on illegal number. You might think that the tale of No Pants Land featuring your favorite pajamas is silly, but we are already living in this world, fairy tale or not. Let's pick a specific example. When crossing U.S. borders with a big bag of money, you are required by law to declare how much money you have on you if it is more than $10,000. Or 114,869,910 satoshis at the time of this writing. Quote, if a person or persons traveling together and filing a joint declaration, CBP Form 6059-B, have $10,000, 114,869,910 satoshis, or more in currency or negotiable monetary instruments, they must fill out a, quote, report of international transportation of currency and monetary instruments, FinCEN 105, former CF 4790, end quote. This is easily enforceable if you bring an actual bag of money with you. Let's assume you have more than $10,000, or 114 million sats, in Bitcoin. Where exactly is your money? Is it in the blockchain? Or, for example, everywhere? Is your money your private key? What if your private key was on a small device? What if you bring it with you in the form of just a couple of words on a piece of paper? What if it was a QR code tattooed inside your lips? What if you had $1 billion stored in your brain? Would you have to declare these words in your brain? That's the tricky thing about information. It isn't a thing. It transcends the physical realm. These alien concepts are slowly but surely creeping into our daily lives, changing the power balance of society as they get understood and adopted by more and more people. Like all tools, cryptography is neither all good nor all bad. If used and understood properly, it can be a liberating force. It can enable people to safely speak out and help disseminate information where it would otherwise be censored. It can guarantee freedom of speech and anonymity. It can also enable unstoppable crime, lead to accidental loss of data, and enable new forms of blackmail and extortion. If abused by tyrants, it can be a force of oppression. Despite all this, we should neither fear nor dismiss these technologies. We should strive to understand them. We are already living in a world where both a totalitarian techno-panopticon and an anarcho-capitalist system dreamed up by cypherpunks is a reality. Computers turned the abstract world of mathematics into tangible machines which interact with the world. The internet connected these machines, creating a global, borderless network. Cryptography and decentralization are making information exchange on this network unstoppable. What will happen if more and more things become pure information? What are the consequences of unbreakable and censorship-resistant codes? Graphic of the Liberator Codebook. The code for a 3D printed gun in book form. We are entering a new era. An era where information can be put in digital safes which can't be opened by force. An era where you can transfer value globally and near instantly without anyone's permission. An era where physical artifacts can be downloaded and printed for near zero marginal cost. An era where world-changing inventions can be made by unknown entities. An era where you can turn anything into magical cryptographic dust, and all you have to do to turn it into something meaningful again is to speak some magic words. And that concludes The Magic Dust of Cryptography by Gigi at DerGigi on Twitter and on this website at DERGIGI.com. Nothing else there, just DerGigi.com. And he used a couple of XKCD comics. There's actually a lot of little graphics. I think I mentioned like two or three of them. But every time I had like a little break, it shows the private key and like a hex, the hex like color codes, which I thought was really interesting because I never really thought about the fact that like hex color codes have just any number between like the min and max. So technically you could encode any private key as hex colors. I didn't even think about that. And then they actually show it the exact same thing that they show as like a big bar across the screen, but as just a 1 pixel per color, so that you can see, like, you can zoom in and just look at the teeny tiny little line that has each color, and just you can just grab that 1 pixel and recreate your private key. But if you hid that somewhere in a picture or in some sort of file or something somewhere, nobody would have a clue. Like, you'd never be able to visually pick that out in an image. And it just goes to show, like, I love this article just about the nature of all these things. And I wanted to just direct people to DerGigi.com just because there's so much other stuff to cover. You can see the private key in all these different forms, the Japanese words, the 24-word seed, the shorter and shorter encodings of it from the longest in binary to just a basic number, and then hexadecimal, and then the wallet import format with capitalization and lowercase, which is the normal that you're used to seeing with like private and public keys in Bitcoin. That's the shortest encoding that you have. But remember that everything that happens on the Bitcoin side is just zeros and ones. It's all bits. So, but this really, I love fun analogies. I know I've said that about a million times on this show, But this is a really fun one. I love the, just because of its ridiculousness, the pajama pants and the no pants world, and how you would sneak your pajama pants into this country, and that, everybody's got this dust, and instead of, needing some specific magic potion, all you need is some set of magic words, and you can turn this dust, which you can find in any country in the world, back into your pajama pants, and you can transfer or transmit your pajama pants to anywhere in the world anytime you feel like it. And so there's a whole lot interesting in this, and I just love that analogy, that really brings to bear the power of digital information. And as the physical realm and the digital realm mix, once we get, because it's just an amazing piece. I think this one's by Laurent MT, or I don't know. There's a couple of really good ones that I've read in the past about how proof of work is the bridge between the physical and the digital, because what it does is it creates an irreversible physical cost. Proof of work is that thing which, when you stamp on a block, it proves that there is a cost in the real world to editing digital information, a cost that is not insignificant, and unforgeable costliness, another one of those brilliant considerations or theories brought out by Nick Szabo, of unforgeable costliness being the foundation of what makes a good money secure, is that it cannot be, its scarcity has an unforgeable costliness. You can't hide the fact that you can't create it without a huge cost, and it cannot be faked. The cost has to be put in to either find or manufacture this money. The nature of that is just fascinating, that there is a bridge between those two worlds, that the idea of proof of work is putting a real world energy, a real world having to do like physical work and limited by that physical work in a very, very fundamental way to gain something in the digital realm, to create yourself something in the digital world. And just the whole nature of this digital, all of this piece makes me think of what I've been reading recently, still not done with it, but it's just an amazing work, is The Sovereign Individual, which Dordigi is actually the one, him and I think Citizen Bitcoin, I was having a chat with on Twitter about doing an audiobook version of The Sovereign Individual, which is a big book. It's taken me quite a while to go through it. Of course, I'm reading a lot of other stuff at once. That's kind of my bad habit, is I listen to and read about 10 different things at any one time. I am halfway through like four different videos that I'm watching and maybe two or three different podcast episodes. And then I am also reading like three different books right now. And that's not including my audiobooks that I'm still listening through. I have a very bad habit of spreading myself very, very thin. So not uncommon there. But The Sovereign Individual is excellent. And it's even more amazing that it was written before the turn of the century, before the year 2000. I think it was like 97 or 98, if I'm not mistaken. And it talks so much about things that are going to come that we are basically seeing right now. And that's one of the most fascinating things about it, to see something from a 20-year-old perspective begin to predict things that we are already running into. When he talks about the fact there will be value in a digital currency that essentially can't be counterfeited, that will be able to hold its value outside of the purview of governments. And then 9 years later, or I guess probably 10 or 12 from that perspective, Bitcoin was born. There it was. And after 30 years of trying to create one, it was finally done by Satoshi Nakamoto and whoever they or he is. And it's just such an interesting, that's all this, all that makes me think about is that we're changing the dynamics where everyone is on an even playing field, because the value and control is in a set of information which treats everyone different, like everyone exactly the same. It does not have the hierarchies or like the bodybuilder MMA fighter meets the weak little kid on the internet in the exact same, we're on the even playing field. It doesn't make the MMA fighter any more able to guess a private key than the kid. It's just a really interesting dynamic. And because you can be anywhere in the world at any time, like you can just hop from place to place, like cyberspace just has completely different characteristics. And I think the idea of what information is, like, I love that question. If you have your passport with scrambled information that is your passport, and then you also have a private key, like a sequence of magic words that unlocks that scrambled information, which one is your passport? Which one is there? Because the scrambled information is utterly meaningless if you don't have the magic words. And if you have the magic words, it doesn't mean anything without the scrambled information. And where's the scrambled information? What if it's on 1,000 different computers all at once? Like, where is your passport? Does it actually exist? And that's just a really interesting thing to break down, because it is all just information. And I love the Wikipedia article on, like, illegal numbers, because it would legitimately just anything that was then assigned value, and they attempted to control what value could or could not be translated or communicated, it literally would suggest that this specific number, just because we have assigned it value, now is illegal. It just nobody can move around with this number in particular, 1,573,489.12, because it is being used to lock a Bitcoin, is now illegal to move across the border. Just that number. If you 0.95, you're good to go. You're good to go. Just don't write that other number down, or think really hard about memorizing that one number, because now it's illegal. And you see how utterly absurd it is, because all of this is just information. And I just really loved this article because it was short, sweet, to the point, and just makes a really, really fun analogy for breaking into that concept, which is a fundamental shift. We really are moving into a new era. And I like the way the sovereign individual positions it, is that we're moving into the fourth type of human civilization. The fourth epic or something of, man, I can't even remember. But it's the first chapter in The Sovereign Individual, is that we're like the fourth type of society, of human society. And it goes through like the hunter-gatherer, the early agricultural, then the industrial age, and now we are moving into the information age, and how we are turning into network societies instead of geographic, like industrial societies. And I actually like the idea, I think it makes more sense with like a networked society, because our relationships are being governed by network protocols. It's exactly what Bitcoin is doing, is it's creating a system. It's essentially creating a property rights system that is more objective, easily definable, and easily verifiable and secured without a government or a court. That's another brilliant work by Hasu Fly and Suzu about independent property rights. It's one of my favorite articles just on the concept of what Bitcoin is, that it's a competing property rights stack for Bitcoin. Basically secures all property rights of digital capital in direct competition to the government jurisdiction, the judicial, and then the enforcement stack, which is what we are used to in the physical world. That huge, massive, costly stack of industry and authority has essentially been replaced when it comes to money by the system of Bitcoin. It is directly in competition. It is not reliant on it at all. In fact, it guarantees ownership in spite of a government dictate or a jurisdictional enforcement of some sort. Because if they don't have, the government can come out and bang a hammer and say, you do not own these Bitcoins. But if you have the private key, they don't, then they're banging a hammer doesn't mean jack. Like, you still are the only one in control of the Bitcoins because the cryptography is a defense against them. Their guns can't shoot through the keys or break the key. They have to get the key from you in some form or fashion, which they may be able to do, but that does not, that shows that they are limited because they have to get the key from you. They have to put a backdoor into your computer or watch you. Shows that they are restricted by the rules of the protocol just as you are. And that's a wholly different world. It's a different, everything is going to change because of this. And I think this is just a continuation of what we've seen cryptography and the internet change. And I think it's going to accelerate. And, ooh, it's just going to be a crazy world. There is not a more interesting time to be alive than right now, in my opinion. And I think we're seeing the culmination of this with this global currency war, clashing of cultures everywhere across the globe, of people segmenting into their own little networked cultures and echo chambers, which I don't think, like, people talk about how this is like a terrible thing that we don't do in the real world, but it's like, what are you talking about? When was the last time you regularly conversed or hung out with people and talked about something that you vehemently disagree on, like, at the core? How many, like, stark SJWs are hanging out with Republicans in the real world lately? It's like, no, this is not something new. This has been human nature for a long time. We're just clashing in a much bigger, like, public square than we ever were before. In fact, you could probably argue that ideas are crossing those boundaries more often than they were, just because we see each other's perspectives. We are exposed to it. It might not necessarily be a good thing. It's obviously led to a lot of hate and frustration and build up tensions. But I think that's the nature of the fact that we're undergoing a massive change. Change is stressful, and things are changing incredibly fast. And Bitcoin and cryptography and the internet are all at the heart of it. So I think not paying attention to this is one of the stupidest, most ill-advised things that a person could do, to not be watching the tools and the technology that are absolutely turning the entire world on its head and changing everything. And I really love this piece by Dergigi that covers this really fun example of it. So thank you so much for listening, and a thank you again to Dergigi for this article. Don't forget to go to Dergigi.com and or what's the one, the 21lessons.com? Is it actually that, or is it Dergigi? Okay, no, it's Dergigi.com/Bitcoin/lessons. So if you just go to Dergigi.com, you'll see it. And we are probably going to be covering this in audio soon, but it is 21 lessons learned from falling down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. And it is an excellent set of stuff. And don't forget, you can also kind of get an overview of this in a really fun 2-hour episode of the Citizen Bitcoin podcast. But we will be covering it in full audio on this show very soon, and we will see how that goes. Much to talk about, much to read, as always. And with that, if you would like to support this show, if you are getting value out of this show, me survives on donations, essentially, and listener support. And if you would like to become a supporter of the show, you can go to anchor.fm, and that will be the biggest thing that you can do to keep this show going and keep me reading and discussing and covering all these different topics in Bitcoin. And I also urge you to take advantage of anchor.fm's voice messages. A huge shout out. Thank you, Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, for being my first voice message. I forgot to mention that. I should have done that at the beginning of the show. But that was a great one. He had a comment on the whole Bcash thing, and it was really great. In fact, I may grab a little snippet from it to throw in the show next time. So thank you to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, and I'll remember to toss them a little shout out at the beginning of the next show, since it's probably going to be heard by more people. And yes, so if you want to drop a comment, a question, something you want me to cover on the show, or like answer in the intro real quick before we get into some work or on the next Guys Take episode, please drop me a voice message. That was really fun. I'm going to really, really enjoy just going through and listening to everybody's messages. And I want to start doing that, like talking to my audience more, because most of the time I'm just sitting here in front of my computer and then I find out a bunch of people listen to it. So it's good to actually interact with you guys. So that's a great way you can do it. And again, you can become a supporter of the show in that same spot. You can do $1 a month, $5 a month, whatever it is. And I'm getting together a bunch of goodies for you guys who are supporting the show. Thank you so, so much for everyone who has donated. Another great place you can do that if you don't want to do a monthly, but just drop me a couple of Satoshis. You can tip my Lightning tipping.me jar. You can buy my holiday calendar and actually get the Bitcoin holiday calendar in your own like iCalendar or Google Calendar or whatever it is, so it notifies you of all the Bitcoin holidays. That is on cryptoeconomy.life. And then, of course, you can just donate Bitcoin through the QR code, all on cryptoeconomy.life. So there's a bunch of different options on cryptoeconomy.life. So check me out up there if you want to dig into that stuff. We've also got about a billion other episodes of this show. So that will do it. Thank you guys so much. I will catch you all tomorrow with another episode. Not sure what I'm covering tomorrow, but we will get into it. It's going to be fun. It's going to be exciting. Don't miss it. Subscribe to the show. Share it with all the people you know in the Bitcoin and crypto economy space who want to learn about this awesome stuff. I'm Guy Swan. I am out. You're listening to the Crypto Economy Podcast, and I will catch you all tomorrow. Until then, take it easy, guys.